Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Opinions expressed on the First Coast Connect Week in Review are those of our panelists and do not reflect the views of WJCT News 89.9.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our First Coast Week in Review. A presidential debate marked by missteps and misinformation. A massive taxpayer investment locks down the Jaguars for another 30 years. The city council steps in after the Downtown Investment Authority punts on a historic redevelopment project. And Duval taxpayers will foot the bill for the actions of a teacher sex offender. To talk about all that and more, I am joined by David Bauerlein, Metro reporter at the Florida Times Union. Good morning, David.
Good morning, everybody.
Also joined by John Daigle, political consultant, longtime former reporter and owner of Daigle Creative. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Ann. Thanks.
Ann Maxwell, investigative reporter at News for Jax. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Ann. Thanks for having me.
And Jim Piggott, Metro reporter at News for Jax, who I am welcoming to the program for the first time since I became host. Just happens to be his penultimate day at work.
That's right. We're towards the end. Monday will be the last day, but I've been here once before, so right before you started. So this is my second time.
No, just with me. It's the first
time. That's true. That's
try not true. To take it personally.
That's true.
Glad to
you
see
tried,
you.
You tried, right.
Thanks to all of you for being here. I appreciate it. It's hard to imagine that we'd be starting with anything other than the Jaguars stadium deal, first off, John, but this was an enormous moment last night, a historic debate. You've been a political consultant and an analyst here in Jacksonville of politics for years, so this is kind of your wheelhouse. What happened in last night's debate?
Yeah, I mean, it was as you said, a historic moment in politics. It's hard to imagine another debate that changed the nature of an election so much as what we saw last night. It was hard to watch. I read one columnist this morning who described it as Rip Van Winkle versus Pinocchio. it was certainly a bad night for Biden. I mean, anybody who watched it was probably surprised at how, I mean, his main job was to look strong, and he did not look strong last night. He did finish stronger than he started, but there is, you know, a lot of what's been described as panic in Democratic circles about what to do now. There's discussions about whether or not he will be the nominee. There's people floating, you know, passing around the rules in terms of what can happen at the convention. It is an entirely new ball game today than it was yesterday. There's still a lot of questions. I mean, his consultants were putting out from the very beginning of the debate the spin that he had a head cold and that he was off. And I think the next couple of weeks are going to be really important to find out whether or not last night was just a bad night or whether we were actually seeing the real Joe Biden.
And for people who didn't stay up to watch the debate, it started at 9 o'clock last night. Give us a sense of what some of the moments were in the debate that were so defining and that kind of left that being the larger story.
In general, his whole style, I mean, he had a lot of really strong issue on the issues and the points, but his style, he talked in a mumbling, hard to understand, halting speech. He missed so many opportunities. Trump just teed up issue after issue that Biden could have hit out of the park on January 6th, on Charlottesville, on immigration, on abortion. And Biden missed almost every opportunity to hit those out of the park. He let former President Trump get away with so many obvious mistruths without calling him on it, and the moderators weren't calling him on it either. So it was really hard to watch, and it's got a lot of people inside the Democratic Party really wondering what the next move for them is today.
One thing that's interesting is that, you know, the viral moments from this debate, unlike prior debates where you're usually exchanging zingers, this is almost like the moments are these agonizing exchanges or just outlandish claims, but not anything that resonates in terms of like a quip or a really well-delivered line.
Yeah, and even, you know, even the quips, he did have a couple. I mean, he prepared, and he did have a couple quips. But even the ones he had were hard to understand. I missed, he had the quip about you have the morals of an alley cat. Mm-hmm. I didn't even understand him when he said that last night. When I read it this morning, I read it and said, oh, that's what he said. But I when he said it in the debate, I couldn't understand what he was saying.
David, I've noticed this is also just, you know, kind of a very pedestrian debate. You know, you have them exchanging lies. That's just wrong. Those are lies, or, you know, that's ridiculous, insane, and very stupid. You know, they're accusing each other of acting like children. It just seems like perhaps there's no great orators in the world of politics these days. It is a different kind of level of debate. It just seems a little juvenile.
Definitely. I thought that was the case. I mean, I'm in the tail end of the baby boom generation, and there must be a lot of people out there who are of that, of a younger generation, who go, when is it going to be our turn? And is this really the best our country has to offer? And, you know, age takes a toll on everybody. And so I think, you know, maybe you could. So, yes, it was not there was no soaring rhetoric. There was no real back and forth that maybe left people more enlightened. Just a lot of talking points thrown out there. Maybe if you just read the transcript, you'd say Biden did okay. If you turned the sound off and just went on visual expressions, you probably would have said he did not do well. I mean, the sort of listening with his mouth open and kind of this dazed look just didn't really go over well. And then to John's point, yeah, it's hard to hear him. You know, I mean, there were times where if it's a head cold or whatever, his delivery was really difficult. And I'm skeptical that it was just a head cold issue. I mean, I do think there's going to be a lot of analysis within the Democratic Party about whether this really is who they want to be their standard bearer. He always said he was a bridge to the next generation. Maybe they'll say the bridge needs to be built sooner rather than after you try to win a second term.
You know, Jim, it was interesting because after the debate, he went to speak to his supporters and he was actually very animated. He was kind of, you know, this mild swear words and, you know, a call to action and exhorting his crowd for their support. But he also made it clear that he's relying on fact checkers to, you know, over the next days and weeks to tease through what the former President Trump said and to kind of make that case that maybe he didn't make.
It was interesting. He went to the Waffle House. Yeah, and that's where he was talking. And he said there, at least that's what the reports this morning, he goes, it's hard to debate a liar. And I just kind of went, but I think former President Trump, he came across, he got his points across. Everything that he said, a lot, fact checkers need to check this, but when we were watching that debate, he got everything across he wanted to get across. It was hard watching President Biden. I mean, it was kind of embarrassing to watch him and just what was happening there. And I think this is, obviously, it's not going to play off well for the Democrats. It's going to play off very strong for the Republicans. And the independent voters, you know, they're the ones that they were gearing this towards. And fact-checked or not, that's how it came across. And it was interesting to watch, but it was very hard to watch. I just had to, I was surprised. I was asking before we went on the air if you guys were surprised how this played out. I mean, it was just, it's going to go down, I think, in election history as one of those debates that, you know, when we saw Kennedy and Nixon, when they first debated at that time, when we're going back to the baby boomer debate, this one's going to be important.
And I wondered, you know, the rules of this debate were very specific and they seemed in some cases tailored to help Biden in terms of the mic silencing between the, you know, the comments and, you know, the rules. I'm actually kind of forgetting the other ones, but one thing that I think perhaps didn't help, and I'm curious what you think, was the absence of an audience. I guess that's one that perhaps could have benefited Biden. There have been other debates where, you know, Trump supporters have been very loud, you know, and kind of present in a debate. But in this case, it seemed like maybe the energy that he may have fed off of and that we kind of saw after the debate wrapped up when he was talking to his supporters, that kind of reemerged. Maybe that was, you know, partly something that ended up being damaging.
You know, I think this kind of stripped down debate style, you could really get a sense of who these candidates are on their own, not feeding off of a crowd's energy or going after the moderator like they did with former President Trump did with Chris Wallace in that one really disastrous debate. So you could really get a chance to hear what they had to say and their points without making it about a fight with the moderators or whatnot. And I think when we got the chance to see that, it was very disappointing.
Yeah. And I would echo that. And I would say, ironically, kind of the thing that made this really a Greek tragedy was, you know, the Biden campaign set up those rules and it really worked in Trump's favor. Trump's main job, the only thing he had to do last night, was look stable. I mean, that's, and the fact that there wasn't an audience there, which gets him jazzed up, and the fact that he knew the mics would get cut off, forced him to do what he had to do last night, was come across stable for those 11, 15% undecided voters. And I think, you know, that's that format really worked in his favor to help him come off as probably one of the best debate performances I've seen from him.
And the mics, they were cut off, but they still were interacting with each other. That's what I, you know, talking across, I thought that was kind of interesting too.
Yeah. It struck me, as you were saying, John, that, you know, in terms of moments in campaign history, the one that seems closest to my mind is Howard Dean, where he kind of had that electric scream one night when he was running for president. And it was like the next day, everybody was like, he's maybe sounding unhinged. He doesn't really sound presidential. And it really seemed to flip things for him. But what are the options that Democrats even have at this point?
Well, there are a lot of options. Again, we're 40 days before the convention. And you know, you've got some old timers around this table who can remember the times when the nominee was actually selected at conventions. So it's entirely possible. Now, it is true that maybe Biden was sick last night. Maybe today when he speaks in Virginia, we'll see, you know, the Biden that we all thought we would see last night. But if his age is a problem, and if that's the true Biden, then the Democrats have 40 days to discuss how they could fix this at the convention. And the campaign could really begin after the convention. At this point, because Biden has the delegates, he would have to release them. So nothing can happen unless Biden voluntarily steps aside. But there are a lot of things that could happen if he did decide to voluntarily step aside.
And what are some of those things?
Well, I mean, Harris would be the obvious choice to step up. A lot of people talk about a possible Harris-Newsom ticket, although that's problematic because they're both California residents. One of them would have to move out of California.
He's sort of like a Trump Rubio.
Yeah. So there, and there are a lot of, I mean, Whitmer, Brown, there are a lot of really strong Democrats. It, you know, there could, you could argue that maybe this was the worst thing that could have happened for Trump, because a lot of people did not believe Biden was going to be able to beat Trump. Would a Harris-Newsom ticket be stronger than a Biden-Harris ticket? We don't know. But what we probably will see is a very, very interesting Democratic convention.
It was interesting to see that, you know, Whitmer actually had a big profile in the New York Times just this last weekend, talking about, you know, wanting a Gen X, you know, representative in the White House. And could she be, would she be, you know, a possible contender. And,
but imagine the scenario of a former federal prosecutor running against a convicted felon. I mean, a Harris against Trump would be a very interesting scenario.
I want to take a call from Sally in St. Augustine. Good morning, Sally. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. I just want to ask, why wasn't the embarrassing part the blatant lies that Trump told? On every newscast I've seen since the debate, the first thing is how Biden fumbled the debate, President Biden. And also, why was it President Biden's job to both fact check, get his point across, and be a good orator for this debate? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And I would agree. I think that there is a lot of people saying, why weren't the CNN moderators calling him on some of this stuff? And I would agree that it was Joe Biden's responsibility to call him on this stuff. Sometimes it's kind of like drinking from a fire hose. There's so much of it coming, it becomes impossible to fact check him. But I mean, when you talked about a historical moment like the Dean scream, to me, it was the lack of a moment. Donald Trump stood up there and said, I did not have sex with a porn star. And Biden didn't respond to that. I mean, you might have a lot of debate about the whole, you know, catch and kill thing or any of the details around his criminal conviction. But not many people, even the hardcore MAGA Trump people that I talked to, deny that he probably did have sex with porn star. And that went without challenge. So, yeah, I think it is hard. And Biden said it in the Waffle House afterwards. It's hard to debate a liar. But at some point, you have to challenge some of that stuff. And I think that's one of the big failures of Biden last night.
I think the moderators did, you know, at least when they were asking, would you accept the results of the election, David? They did, I think, come back three times to that and finally extracted an answer, which was along the lines of, as long as it's a fair election and it's not rigged, I'll accept the results, which maybe isn't all that different than what happened in the last election. But what do you think about the point that our caller made in terms of the headline being Biden's performance as opposed to Trump's misinformation? And there was quite a bit of it.
Well, I saw coverage of both. I think for Biden, the main thing is he is the incumbent. He's running for reelection. And I saw an interview with Claire McCaskill, the former senator from Missouri, who basically said Biden had one job to do yesterday, and that was to show the country he was fit to continue as president for four more years. And when he didn't pass that bar, based on all the commentary, all the reactions that we've seen, we've talked to people who all had the same reaction, that became the fundamental story coming out of that debate.
We have a couple of questions I want to ask. One was, do we know the size of the viewing audience? And I think that's an important question, too, just in terms of who is actually watching, who is actually paying attention, particularly for some younger viewers. I don't know if we have an idea of that.
I don't have an exact numbers. It was broadcast on almost every station, and it was promoted as probably one of the most historic debates of all time. So my guess is it had extremely high viewership. Now, whether those 11 to 15% of undecided voters were tuning in, that's me to be the very important question.
Yeah. We also have some comments, just people critical of Trump's performance, but also acknowledging that they think Biden missed some opportunities to capitalize on those faults. So it's going to be interesting. Jim, I'm just curious, you know, when it comes to local politics, which is something that you have been covering for a long time now, typically, you know, these candidates will come through, we'll have people join them on stage. We saw that the last time when Trump was running, President Trump was running. We had a lot of local politicians there. He's coming through again just a couple weeks before the election. He's going to be here in September with Tucker Carlson doing an appearance. How do you expect local politicians to line up? Do you think it will be similar to what we saw the previous?
I think it's going to be exactly the way we saw it before. You know, the Republican base here, that is the council members, the former mayors, different. I think we're definitely going to see that play out again. You know, before we had the Tea Party before that and the local aspects of that. I don't think we're going to be seeing that, but we're going to be seeing, I think, a lot of, you know, that strong Republican side and the Democratic side here since Duval County is shifting. I mean, we're seeing that in the elections, but I still, when Trump comes through here, you're going to see a huge crowd.
Well, we're talking about the top stories of the week with our panel of journalists, Ann Maxwell, David Bauerlein, John Daigle, and Jim Pigott. You can join our conversation by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or reach out on social media. I want to move on now to another much-discussed news story, the stadium deal. It received final approval on Tuesday night by the city council. Let's hear how Council President Ron Salem called for that vote.
I'm going to sit down and say, open the ballot, record the vote.
14 yeas, 1 nay, 2 abstain.
By your vote, we have scored a touchdown. It is my pleasure to say, by your vote, you have approved 2024-904 as amended. Thank you.
Jim, you've been around a long time, 39 years or so in this market?
That's right.
Yeah. So you remember the first stadium deal?
I remember the first stadium deal. There was so much debate at that time, too, dealing with bed tax money going in, JEA money that was being used, money that they were doing to pay off the stadium, and the promises that were made, what the stadium was going to do for the community at the time. You know, the renderings that came out, and a lot of that was kept, but it was the same debate. I think what was interesting in this debate that happened over is those that abstained from this, and, you know, they pulled the CBA plan, the community benefits agreement, so everyone could vote on this, but they couldn't vote on it, and the thought was, why didn't they put the CBA back in then, since not everybody could vote? So there's still a lot of questions about the politics behind all of this, which were the politics behind in the other stadium as well. I remember people speaking out when all that came down.
Yeah, and I'll follow up because I covered that too, and I remember it was actually probably a lot more contentious than the current one. I remember the Weavers, at one point, the whole negotiations broke down. The Weavers packed up and went back to Connecticut, and everybody in town had thought that Jacksonville was just being used as a decoy because they wanted another city. It was, compared to what we saw in the last few months, it was much more contentious under Mayor Austin during that first set.
And what do you credit that to, John? I mean, obviously they're here. It perhaps makes a little bit less in question whether they're going to leave or stay as long as they get their way, and they did. But do you think it's the leadership? Do you think it's just that their community support is stronger?
And that's a tough question, and I probably would defer to the journalists in the room who actually covered this, because I didn't actually cover these. I just read about it in the newspaper. I think at this point, back in those days, you had – the council was not one solid block the way we've seen in the past few years. You had what they called the naysayers. You had a group of four or five who voted almost against anything Mayor Austin did. And that always led to some contentious discussions on the council. You don't see that kind of block of dissension in as much in the current council as you did in those days.
That's interesting. David?
I can say one difference, I think, is in 1993, if you voted yes, you were opening yourself to criticism that you're a wasteful taxpayer spender without any guarantee that your yes vote was going to result in getting a team, because there really were a long shot. So it's kind of a political risky vote in that sense, kind of a leap of faith to say, yes, I'm for it. Whereas now it's the opposite way. If you vote no, you're the one who's really taking the risk, because you vote no and the team leaves, then you've got you're the council and the city leaders who let the Jaguars go, and there's no way that NFL is coming back after a vote like that from a market of Jacksonville size. So it's a different political dynamic. Obviously, the Jaguars have a fan base. That was important that they built up. And I think ultimately it just boiled down to, does Jacksonville want to pay the price to be an NFL city? And they did.
And Ann, obviously there's still folks grappling with this cost, $775 million in public funding. But it does come with this 30-year non-relocation agreement. So the solidity of the team is something that the community, I think, has expressed that they want, even though the cost was perhaps not what they were looking for.
Yeah, I feel like Jags fans can kind of be the loudest voice in the room sometimes. I mean, those are people who are paying attention, who are passionate, and they don't want that team to go anywhere.
So the question of the CBA, Jim, I want to ask you about, because you noticed that the community benefit agreement is something that came out. They split out most of it or much of it. The $94 million basically pulled out of that CBA, $56 million left intact, but most of that is Jaguars money as opposed to city money. Donna Deegan, Mayor Deegan, addressed that shortly after the vote. Let's hear what she had to say.
To all of you who mentioned how disappointed you were that this agreement was split apart, I was too. But you know what? It will just offer us another opportunity to come together and to create an agreement that will be good for Jacksonville. And I know we will do it. And the folks at Out East have been patient, and I know that we're going to get it done for them.
What do you think, Jim? Are they getting it done for the folks out East?
I think it's going to change. And that's my opinion. I can say that now because I'm retiring. I don't usually like to give opinions. But just talking to people and talking to them, because that's the most contentious thing among city council right now, that they're debating it. They're making this a political fight, not for the East Side community, not for the citizens of Jacksonville. But I think this is all just politics going back and forth. And it's unfortunate that that's what I see happening here. We see the parks, everybody's happy with that, the $56 million that's going in to redo everything along here. But that East Side community, there were promises made back in the original stadium that was going to benefit from this. I went out there just a couple weeks ago with Warren Jones, who was a city councilman at the time, after the vote. He says, yeah, well, they're parking. People park out here, so the East Side is getting something. I said, Warren, they're parking. That's it. They're not going there to those restaurants that are there. And he's going, hopefully that will happen this time. I want to see that happen, but, I mean, those same promises were there. We're seeing that with the hotel being built, the Four Seasons. Yes, all of that's going up right now. But that East Side community, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen out
there. How do you think it might change? I mean, if they get in and they start, wiggling around with what Deegan has proposed that would benefit the East Side community. Do you think that just money would be taken from that community expenditure wholesale, or do you think it would be more, they just want to know more details, as they've kind of said, about what exactly that money will go towards?
Because I don't think they know exactly what that money will go to. I know the historic East Side community, they're working hard to make sure that people don't get priced out of that community. The people that live there, the property, the land values on that, they're trying to make sure, because that's a big concern too. The people that are there now is like, well, you know, investors are going to come in, buy up all of this, and then we have to say bye to this historic community. That's a lot of concern that I know from talking to people over there. So talking to businesses over there, they're hopeful, and they thought it was going to be happening, particularly when the Doro was opening. Oh, we'll see investment. Then, unfortunately, the fire happened there. There's just a lot of concern, I think, of what's going to happen to the East Side, not only the historic East Side, but all the North Side communities as well.
Well, I want to move on and talk to about another issue that has to do with downtown development. It's one that you've been covering, David Bauerlein, pretty intently. What do we know now about the Laura Street Trio? I mean, that has been, you know, decades waiting for something to happen, but there was a lot of activity on it this week.
Right. Basically, what's happening this week is the Downtown Investment Authority staff has basically said enough with the negotiations. It's time to just stop any more talks with the owner of the Laura Street Trio about getting those historic buildings that are in the middle of downtown, big eyesores, refurbished, renovated, restored into something that really draws people to downtown. So they're saying, it's just too much money from taxpayers that the developer is asking us to put into this property. And it does not make fiduciary sense for us to commit that amount of public funding for this project. The developer needs to go out, find another partner who's maybe more financially strong, come back to us then, and then we can talk. So that's kind of where the Downtown Investment Authority is. Now, the city council, though, also has a special committee that is looking at downtown development and the future of downtown, and they're interested in also taking a look at the Laura Street Trio. So it could be that you're going to have council members looking at how to craft or fashion a deal, and the DIA's recommendation would be don't do it, but the city council can always still do it. And if you have 10 votes, then you have 10 votes for doing it. So it's going to be a very amorphous process now if it goes to city council.
What is the role of the DIA supposed to be in these kinds of deals? I mean, why are they involved? Remind us what the function of the DIA is and why it would be unusual for the city council to step in and take that over.
Yeah, the Downtown Investment Authority's job is to negotiate development deals within the downtown area. And that's what they've been doing now for the past decade or so. Now, what they do is they will come together with a package of incentives, and then they recommend it to city council, and city council votes it up or down, maybe makes a few minor tweaks to it. In this case, it sounds like the DIA will recommend, don't do a deal with this developer until he comes back with another partner. And so there will be a recommendation from DIA. It just won't be a recommendation to do a deal. And then city council will have to weigh that and decide whether they still want to do a deal.
This special committee, though, is going to be taking this up. City Council President Ron Salem, and one of the last things that he did, issued this memo saying, let's have this special committee on downtown look at it. So regardless of what DIA votes on today, whether they recommend, going with it or not, it sounds like the city is going to be getting its hands dirty in this deal, in terms of negotiating and...
Yeah, but you kind of question, how is that going to happen? How can a city council committee negotiate a deal with the developer? I mean, they have a hard time coming together on anything. They're usually a reactive body. You bring us something, we vote on it. Now they would be initiating it. So this is all new territory, definitely. But this whole Laura Street Trio over the last decades, I don't know, how long have you been there, Jim? 39 years? I don't know how many of those years the Laura Street Trio has been vacant and waiting for somebody to develop it. But it's just, it has reached the point where time is not on its side. And it's frustrating to everybody. There hasn't been a deal to move forward on it.
You had mentioned that memo that came out from Ron Salem. And the story, there's a story about that memo that actually originated from Jason Gabriel, who's working with the developer for the Laura Street Trail.
So Jason Gabriel is a former city general counsel,
right,
of the city.
Dave sent that to Council President Salem. It was tweaked one line saying we need to form this committee to look at downtown investment. And Ron Salem put that out there. He admitted that he changed the one line on that. So they're actually behind this committee that was formed to look at downtown. Again, as I said with other things, this has turned political. That the whole downtown investment thing is another political move.
So explain, for people who aren't in the weeds on this and following along, I mean, so having the former city attorney write a memo that the city council president issued, what is the significance of that?
I think it's what the role of how, what they're getting at, and this is what we're hearing, it's the role of the Downtown Investment Authority. They want to see...
They being?
Obviously the developer. And sending this out, getting this committee to take a look at what's happening downtown, the city council committee, which was, you know, they were supposed to wrap up their work by now. They're going to extend that, obviously. That is just what is happening with that. That they, you got to look, why would the council president take this verbatim from the developer who's going to benefit from all of this and form this committee? And that's what the whole idea is. A lot of it has to do with Lori Boyer. They weren't happy with the current head of the DIA, and that's where all of this started. I know it's a lot of weeds, a lot of things that are in there people may not understand, but that's what came out from all of this.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, Jim, in particular, because, as you say, this is all coming at a time when there is a lot of attention and expressed dissatisfaction with the work that the DIA is doing in terms of, is it moving quickly enough to jumpstart downtown? And Lori Boyer, as the head of that, has been under fire, and some people have been calling for her job. But at the same time, you have a very powerful bunch of people representing this developer, including Jordan Ellsbury, who's right, the former chief of staff for the former mayor, Lenny Curry. He now works with him at a lobbying firm. So they work together. And Jason Gabriel, as you say, the former city attorney, right, also representing,
right,
the developer.
Right. And that's what I'm saying. We're looking at this play out, the pressure that's playing out from that, and the fact that I know that DIA was surprised when this came up once again that, oh, the council was going to take this up. And they're just like throwing their hands up in the air. Why is this happening? You know, there's just a lot of concern about all of that.
Yeah, and from a big picture standpoint, to me, and being a little bit cynical on some of this stuff, it's kind of a follow the money story. You know, I remember right after Better Jacksonville passed and there was a ton of money about to flow into the decisions made by the DIA and those looking at downtown, all of a sudden they came under a huge microscope and people got very interested. We've had the DIA for many years. It's downtown is kind of languished. Nobody's cared about it. I have to wonder if some of what we're seeing now with Lori Boyer and the DIA and the intense scrutiny on that has something to do with the fact that we're about to pump a ton of money into downtown through the stadium deal.
And carry that forward one little bit for us.
Well, I mean, when downtown was languishing and there wasn't a whole lot of public funding available for projects and things to happen, it didn't seem like the DIA got a lot of attention. But now with the community agreement and the fact that hundreds of millions of dollars are about to become available for projects in the downtown area, I think there's going to be a lot more interest on who's calling the shots with how that money's going to be spent.
David, I'm just curious because there are these moments where it seems like a lot of attention all of a sudden burbles up from somebody expressing dissatisfaction. In my mind, I think a little bit back to like when all of a sudden everybody was really dissatisfied with what was happening at JEA right after the former mayor took office, and it became, you know, imminent, imperative that we clean house over there and kind of get some new people on the board. And then in retrospect, it appears, you know, that was kind of part of a larger shift towards trying to sell that utility. What do you think is happening here?
Well, I think from the Southeast and the Laura Street Trio developers, if they feel like they can't get a deal with the Downtown Investment Authority, then it benefits them to try and minimize the credibility of the DIA and its recommendation to City Council. So there could be some of that happening. I mean, the Downtown Investment Authority has doubled the population in downtown over the past decade. They've done dozens of projects in downtown. It's not been an on-fire decade, but they have added residents and people in downtown. And they have done at least two, maybe if you could even count three deals with Southeast to do Laura Street Trio. And each time, you know, the idea is, okay, the developer says, thank you, we're ready to go, and then nothing happens. So there's two sides to that story. I mean, and they really stretched, I thought, with a pretty generous incentive package in these latest round of negotiations, just not as far as the developer wanted to go in terms of wanting almost $89 million as the incentives, and almost all of it is cash, and almost all of it will be paid before construction even starts or during construction. That's very unusual for incentives to be paid into the project. Usually it's, we'll provide you incentives and we'll give you property tax rebates after you do it, you know.
Sure.
Show it to us, and then we'll incentivize you, get it done. Now you're really saying, you know, this would have been a deal that would have put a lot of taxpayer money on the line.
Up front.
And, you know, if it works out, then that's great. But if not, that's money that's not only, it's money out the door, you know.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, we're talking about the top stories of the week. You can call us at 904-549-2937 to join the conversation. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can tag us on social media. I want to move on now to a topic, Ann Maxwell, that you've been covering extensively now for well over a year. There was a civil settlement announced this week in a case involving a former teacher at Douglas Anderson School of the Arts. That's a case that had a criminal component that you covered and we've talked about previously, but this was a civil lawsuit. Tell us what this case was about and what happened this week.
Right. So these are cases, my understanding, involving Jeffrey Clayton at Douglas Anderson School of the Arts. This is the former longtime music teacher there who pleaded guilty and has been sentenced to 10 years in prison for crimes involving inappropriately touching a student. So one of those suits was filed. It was a sexual harassment lawsuit filed in November. And then two other pre-suit notices were filed, which I believe you have to do when you're suing a government entity. And so on Tuesday, it's on the agenda for the school board to vote on this $1.45 million settlement. That includes the three cases, is my understanding. And one of the plaintiffs and is the victim in the Clayton criminal case. And according to the filing on the school board's website, they're going to be voting on Tuesday. That $1.45 million would be coming out of the general fund budget for the upcoming school year. So, you know, taxpayers are paying for these allegations that the district, the administration at DA looked the other way to Clayton's alleged sexual harassment for years. And the former principal there, Jackie Cornelius, has denied that. But the district has, you know, their representatives have agreed to pay up. And now it's up to the school board to approve that.
This is an enormous settlement, I think. I mean, typically these are capped at about $200,000. You're saying $1.4 million. And I guess we don't know yet kind of how they would accomplish that if there's a cap in place or what might happen. But does that speak to the strength of the lawsuit in terms of the record that existed and prior complaints against this teacher over a period of many, many years?
So the one lawsuit that has been filed that I've seen, the student in particular made really, I mean, just mind-boggling claims that when she was in ninth grade, Jeffrey Clayton told her to do her makeup to make her breasts look bigger and things like that. And this happened, and he would berate her in public, the lawsuit said. And there was an investigation into how he was treating girls in this play she was in at the time. And the investigation, according to the lawsuit, found there had been multiple similar complaints throughout the years. And the investigation, you know, resulted in him returning to the classroom. And it was severely distressing to this ninth grader.
Facts that perhaps they don't want to go in front of a jury.
It would seem so.
Yeah. Jim, this comes at a time unfortunate on a lot of levels for the school district. They are considering school closures. They're looking at, you know, cutbacks. What does it mean to have and obviously it's not until Tuesday that they're going to vote on this, but if it goes through this settlement proposal, $1.4 million come out of the pocket of the school district.
And I think that will bring up a lot of debate as well. We did hear from the victim on this too, you know, or the attorney from the victim saying, you know, this will help, but that is a lot of money. I'm just curious if it's going to bring up other complaints later when people see that they can successfully sue the school board and that they will settle on this. But you're right. What's coming up with all of the development that they want to do, all of the work that they're trying to bring people back to the Duval County schools because of charter schools or whatever's going on, I think this will have a huge impact.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that because, you know, part of the criminal case that was also settled was an agreement that the state attorney would not go after Jeffrey Clayton for additional, allegations that had been raised. What do we know about additional potential plaintiffs? Because he had a lot of students and he had a lot of complaints.
It's a good question. And, you know, I'm not sure what's going to happen, if there could be more lawsuits. But I should mention yesterday, the district sent out a plan to make sure this doesn't happen again to any other students, to, you know, improve training for what's inappropriate conduct with teachers, to really tighten the rules on teacher-student behavior. You're not, you know, according to what they're proposing, the board would also have to approve. Students and teachers wouldn't be allowed to text each other, interact on social media, be alone together, with the exception of things, you know, like if you're a school nurse or a mental health counselor. And so when the interim superintendent, Dr. Dana Krisnar, sent this out, she sent an email to Douglas Anderson parents saying they still had investigators conducting interviews, looking at old allegations to see if there's anything else that needs to be investigated. So, I mean, it could be more to come if that's still underway.
And we're also just less than 2 months away from a pretty significant school board election where a lot of incumbents are on that ballot. And I'm sure these issues are going to become part of those conversations, as well as our brand new superintendent who is just about to start. And I wonder how much the timing of that had to play with the settlement.
Yeah, and I'm not sure we're going to be covering some of those school board races here on and I'm not sure how many incumbents are going to really be queued up, but it is going to be, I think, an outstanding question for whoever is going to be stepping in there about accountability for teachers. This is typically where we go to our lightning round. I just wanted to say we've got a comment on X from Fire Pit Mike. He says, thanks for inviting Jim Pigott. I will miss his intrepid reporting and engaging spirit. Best wishes, Jim. I just want to say it's been great working with you. Jim, you've been a great colleague in the field. We met covering many, many court cases, and you are a great colleague, a pal, and always like reliable, helpful, and just a delight to be around. So thank you so much for your years and years and years.
I've loved it. I love Jacksonville. I loved working here. I thought I'd be here maybe 2 years, 38 years. It's just great.
Yeah. Well, we will miss you, and we hope you'll come back on the show anyway, even if you're out of the seat. You can still come back.
Thank you.
All right. Jim Pigott, Ann Maxwell, David Bauerlein, John Daigle. Thank you all so much for being here today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Join us again Monday. We're going to be talking about the impact of heat on your physical and mental health.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Serious injury cases are complex, and civil trial attorneys present the evidence juries need to see and hear. More at waynehogan.law.
North Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at northfloridatpo.com.
This July 4th, join me, Alfonso Rivero, as I'm back to host America's National Independence Day celebration, a Capital Four, with Smokey Robinson, Sheila E., Fantasia, Darren Criss, Chloe Flower, Fitz and the Tantrums, Lauren Allred, Sean Johnson East, Sister Sledge featuring Sledgendary, and the greatest live fireworks display in the USA. Live from the U.S. Capitol, it's a Capitol 4. Thursday, July 4th, 8, 7 Central, only on PBS.
On the next Florida Roundup, is your condo ready for reforms? It's been 3 years since the tragic collapse of the Champlain Tower in Surfside. That led to new rules for condominium buildings and condo owner associations. So if you live in a condo or own a condo, have you had it inspected? What do the finances of your building look like? Email us, radio@thefloridaroundup.org. This is Tom Hudson. And join us Fridays noon until 1.
On TV, a debate. At the ballot box, a few surprises in a few primaries. And from the Supreme Court, a leak. There's so much for us to catch up on, and we'll get to all of it on the Friday News Roundup next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. After a five-year hiatus, local indie favorites reunite for a homecoming performance that you will not want to miss. Joining me now are the members of Tomboy, Paige McMullen, guitarist. Good morning, Paige.
Good morning.
Alexander Eli, welcome back. You are the guitarist and lead vocalist of Tomboy, also in charge of sampling.
Yes, that is correct.
Thank you for being here. All right. And Summer Wood, Summer the drummer, welcome back.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
Good morning. So all three of you have played in local bands. What brought you together initially for this project?
A friend of mine who is now in the band Dead, that is actually doing pretty well, invited me out to come play at South by Southwest for their showcase. And I was very broke and I did not have a car. And I was telling Paige and Summer this over breakfast one morning after Paige's birthday. And Paige was like, "You're dumb, I'm driving you." And literally threw a French fry at me, and I got them fully integrated in the set. And then we drove to Austin, and our second show or third show is at South by.
I was just going to drive you. You're like, "You should probably play guitar." And I was yeah, cool.
As long as you're going with another musician, join the band.
Uh-huh. And then we walked to Summer's house.
And then we walked to Austin. I'm just kidding.
Summer.
Or hitchhike.
Time to be the drummer.
Yeah. So you were together until 2019. Is that? And then you broke up. Why?
Well, it was around 2020, really influenced by the pandemic. Mm. I mean, So we're all from Jacksonville, and Summer moved to Austin, Texas, with her lovely partner, and
who she met at a Tomboy show.
Oh, wow.
And that's a sweet story. And then I moved out to California, and so we were working online, you know, sending each other music and kind of collaborating, and then the pandemic really shut everything down, and I mean, we haven't played music together, and
this is the first time we've all actually been in the same city together since the end of 2019.
Yeah. Yeah.
Summer, it's hard to overstate how much the pandemic affected musicians in so many ways. But I guess this is evidence that you can kind of bring it back together even after a hiatus of 5 years?
Yeah.
So what do you got?
Back.
Yeah. So what have you got queued up in terms of the show? It's a Pride event. It's at Walrus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Alex.
So Queer Fest, this is our second year doing Queer Fest. It's a part of Duval County Queer Pride, who was founded by BB Deluxe. I decided that was like, you know, all the Pride events in Jacksonville seem to be very centered around drag, particularly, which I love drag, and there's no shame in that game. But Jacksonville is actually pretty busting at the seams with LGBTQIA talent. And what I found, and I had to shut it off at 12 bands on the bill, and they're all LGBTQIA voices from here in North Florida, and there were more that were upset that I couldn't like put them on the show. And what I find it's a really beautiful thing, because when we started Tomboy, there was no queer music scene here, and it was kind of the thing that was really important to us as a group, was we wanted to create inclusive spaces, we wanted to bring safe space culture to the venues in Jacksonville, because historically, the venues in Jacksonville have been owned by pretty problematic cis white dudes, if we're being honest, and a lot of them have essay allegations against them. And traditionally LGBTQIA folks have been left out of those spaces. So when Tomboy was upon its initial inception, it was this need to create a queer music scene, some queer counterculture in the city. And what's really cool is to fast forward 10 years from now and just to see like how culture in general has moved forward, and to bring all of the artists like BB Deluxe and Giella and us and pair them with all these just like new younger voices of queer talent that are in our city. And I think it's particularly important in the state of Florida, where we're seeing so many anti-LGBTQIA laws and legislation. And I personally, as a business owner, feel it's just really important to let people know that there are queer business owners here. There are trans business owners. We want kids to grow up. We want to provide them with safe spaces, and we love them, and they should have safe things to do in their free time.
Yeah, and Paige, that's always been something that as a band has kind of been, you've led with identity as much as music, right? It's been something that you have tried to, you know, incorporate, but also be an advocate, be a symbol, and be somebody that is recognizable in the community as a queer indie band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from our inception, we definitely wanted to own our queerness, because the thing about our identities as queer people is they're already politicized. So owning that and being proud about it is so important, because people are going to put that on you and they're going to put you in a box. And owning your identity and like speaking from like, yeah, your true perspective is really, really important. And yeah, from our inception, we were really vocal in support of the HRO here in Jacksonville.
The Human Rights Ordinance.
Human Rights Ordinance, yes. And as well as just when marriage equality was passed, we were having shows, we were doing fundraisers. Yeah, it's always been something that's been really important. So like you said, it's amazing to see just how far everything has grown in Jacksonville.
Yeah. So the show is Sunday, June 30th. Doors are at 4:00. It's at the Walrus. Tomboy will be there, a bunch of other bands. Thank you so much for being here. I hope you guys have a great reunion show.
Thank you so much. And we'll have lots of limited edition merch.
Yeah, hold up a shirt. Hi. There for us.
We also have other events going on for Duval County Queer Pride. We've got Hoedown tonight, which is our sex-positive honky-tonk. And then we have Drag Fest with 14 drag artists. And everything is sliding scale all weekend because Pride should be accessible.
All right. Well, that's our program. Check us out Monday. As I said, we're going to be talking about the threat of excessive heat and mental health. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to WJCT News, First Coast Connect. Thanks.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.